some ways it's embarrassing. For me, it's embarrassing. But the other, I think there's a wisdom of respect, because if you're a teacher who, you know, everything I know is a reflection of him, if I misrepresent him, you know, so let's teach in different towns so you don't embarrass the teacher. I also think it's also a wisdom in that tradition, because as I've been thinking about it, it's like, it's also, you know, for the sake of the student, because everybody's waiting for the master, and then he sends his student instead. Like, who's this guy? I paid all this money for this retreat, and I get to listen to him, right? So your mind's like, let's see what he's got to say. So I just want you to all realize, of course I would be, I'm honored to do this, but really I'm doing it because Chuadasa requested it, and it's really for his health and benefit, so he can rest and be his full self through the rest of the day. So I'm going to do my best to answer your questions. Many of you I have had interviews with over the last 3 years, and I've been privileged to do that. This is the first time I'll be answering questions in public. So whatever I say, if he says something different, listen to him, okay? And that's key, absolutely critical. So if you raise your hand in the Q&A and say, but Matt said, I'll be like, yeah. Okay? All right, good. So, I'll do my best. And I think we'll just keep it to paper ones, and I'll do this till Monday evening, and then hopefully Chuladasa will feel strong enough to do these evening Q&As, and if he doesn't, I'm sure Jesse will. So, all right. I briefly read these. So let's try to. I think there's only three, and we'll do this one first. How do you suggest we work with honor precept number 10 during the retreat? Let's just so everybody's precept. I undertake the precept to live with mindfulness and follow the Eightfold Path through daily study, meditation, and reflection. It's default, in the sense that you're having Dharma talk in the day, you're meditating, you're being mindful, and you're following the Eightfold Path, right concentration, right effort. In addition, just by being in a retreat setting, you're not killing anything. You're not stealing. You shouldn't be stealing anything. Right? You shouldn't have wrong speech. I mean, this is why I think retreats are so profound, because your morality, your sila, which is a critical piece of the path, is just because you're so internal, because you're minimizing your activities. It's just by default you're honoring your precepts. Now, and it's a great question, and it might be more specific than that, but that's all I really have to say about that, is you are really honoring all the precepts very intensely this whole retreat. So, and the other thing is I'm not used to this format where I just speak and no one talks, but that's fine. I think we should keep, that's how Chuladasa designed it. So if my answers are not satisfying, you can write me a note. You can write me a note tomorrow and tell me. Okay. Despite a regular, consistent practice, I still have gross distractions. I practice introspective attention in general to remedy the gross distractions frequently. Frequently, the remedy is exhausting, as it needs to be on all the time. Okay, let me just read that again. Oh, all right. Despite a regular, consistent practice, I still have gross distractions. I practice introspective attention to remedy the gross distraction, frequently, and peripheral awareness. Frequently, the remedy, introspective attention, is exhausting, as it needs to be on all the time. P.S. And I'll read these out loud, so if you don't want them read out loud, say, please don't read this. The content of the distractions are stupid. Or not important to me. not painful. Even my ego mind realizes the stupidity of them. But if your ego mind is chastising your distractions, it sounds... Wait, okay, we'll get to that. All right, thank you. So let's go piece by piece on this. So there's two types of distractions, as everybody's pretty much familiar with. There's subtle distractions and there's gross distractions. So this person is talking about gross distractions. And Chula Dasa talked about this. The nature of subtle distraction is they eventually become very often gross distractions. And all that means is there's a lot of information in peripheral awareness. And attention flits, alternates, touching those. And if it touches him for, like, let's say, 5 beats on the breath and 3 beats on the distraction, and it's just in the background, it's a subtle distraction. But very often, the subtle distraction starts to get more beats of attention, and so where you were 5 to 2, now the distraction is getting more attention. So where you were, let's say, 80% on the breath and 20% on the subtle distraction, suddenly there's a shift where there is a 80% on the distraction and 20% on the breath. You haven't forgotten the breath. The breath is still within your attention and your awareness, but the distraction is now the primary object of your attention, and therefore it's called a gross distraction. And this person is saying, I use introspective attention to remedy the gross distraction. So, in stage two, stage two, you work with mind wandering. Right? Your mind. So the sequence of events is the mind produces distractions. One of those distractions, subtle or gross, subtle distractions becomes a gross distraction. One of those distractions captures your attention and becomes a gross distraction, and slowly the breath slips out of your awareness. When it completely is gone, that's called forgetting. And then once you've forgotten the meditation object, whatever was in your attention, that distraction, you get tired of it and it slips on to something more interesting, and that's the sequence of mind wandering. So that's really the fundamental sequence you're working through 2, 3, and 4. Distractions, forgetting, to mind wandering. You work on mind wandering first, stage 2. You work on forgetting in stage 3. And then you work on gross distractions on stage 4. So this person is dealing with gross distraction, and she's doing a technique called introspective attention. So when you're dealing with as a culture, we suffer from attention deficit disorder. But as you study more and more with Chula Dasa, what you realize is we, as a culture, we suffer from awareness deficit disorder. And our ability to use our peripheral awareness is very weak compared to our attention. And the reason we use attention so much, overuse attention, is because it's under our conscious control. Awareness is bottom up. It's not under our conscious control. And so therefore, when we're using, just like Chula Dasa was explaining yesterday, when we're using attention all the time, awareness, that peripheral awareness collapses. So when you are working at stage with gross distraction, so you've overcome mind wandering and you you're not forgetting anymore, but for most of the time there's this big gross distraction that's right there. You have to strengthen your peripheral awareness, your introspective peripheral awareness. And the way you do this is, and specifically in stage 3, is you use a technique called introspective attention. And essentially, because our peripheral awareness isn't strong enough, it can't catch those things that make us forget the object, and it can't catch the transformation of a subtle distraction into a gross distraction. So introspective attention is where you are focusing on the breath, and every once in a while you turn your attention in to look at the mind, just to see what's going on with attention. And then you come back to, is there a gross distraction that's already there? Is dullness setting in? And then you come back to the breath. And what that does is that strengthens your peripheral awareness. And that was the point he was making last night about, if you take an interest in cars, if you like Ferraris and Lamborghinis and Porsches, which I like really, really like Porsches, then my awareness is going to begin to filter and alert me to when there's Lamborghinis, Porsches, and Ferraris around. So you're using, by looking inside the mind with attention, you're training awareness and saying, be aware of when there's gross distractions present. So that's the issue that this person is, this is the technique that this person is using. So this person is sitting in meditation, and they're turning their attention inward to look at the mind, and they're saying, oh, wow, there's some gross distraction there. I better tighten up on the focus. And how often the person is doing it, I ask them, I don't know, because she's saying she's getting tired. Which you may be just doing it too much. And this is also a little strange, is because I'm talking to somebody specific, but all of you are listening. So, and I would like to ask you more questions, but we'll leave it right now. So what I would say to this person is you should also, in that practice of turning attention inward to look at the mind and see if there's a gross distraction there, do it less, because you're saying frequently the remedy, introspective attention, is exhausting, as it needs to be on all the time. Don't have it on all the time, was the first thing. It shouldn't be exhausting. Do it every, turn your introspective attention inward, I don't know, once every 6 breaths, I don't know, two times every 12 breaths. You have to play with it, and don't count. So just look inside the mind every once in a while and come back. The other technique I would say is, so what that's going to do, just to make that clear, is that the attention turning inward to the mind is going to strengthen awareness to be more bright. The other thing I would do is labeling. I would say use the practice of labeling. I don't see you mentioning it here, because labeling also strengthens introspective awareness. I found it really actually quite helpful. And So when I say labeling, most of you are familiar with labeling. But the way labeling works is a distraction comes up. It could be a subtle distraction, could be a gross distraction. Give it a quick, simple label. If it's a thought, just say thinking. If it's a feeling, just say feeling. If it's about lunch in the future, say lunch. You don't have to get into the labels. It doesn't have to be complex. It can be very simple. And what that also does is it does two things. It tells you, first of all, it gives you an idea of what the common distractions are in your mind. It gives you a sense of, okay, what are the culprits that really take me away? So that giving it a quick label gives you the ability to see the pattern of distractions that are coming. It also strengthens your introspective awareness as well. So do checking in and labeling together. That's what I would recommend to you. Don't just do the introspective attention. But eventually what you need to do is develop continuous introspective awareness. That's going to be the key to really resolving your gross distraction issue. What does continuous introspective awareness feel like? Or what is the quality of introspective awareness that you're looking for? And the way that I like to feel this, or the way I sense this, is you can even do this when you're doing introspective attention check-in, look into the mind, and come back to the breath at the nose. And at that moment of your return, what you will notice is that your attention is very stable and your awareness is very bright. You'll also see this when you get distracted, mind-wandering. When you bring your attention back and you come back to the sensations of the breath at the tip of the nose, you'll notice this really beautiful balance between attention and awareness. That's the kind of continual quality that you want to develop. And it's almost like a quality that you're looking beyond the breath. It's the mind is watching the mind as the mind watches the breath. It's a kind of constant metacognitive awareness. And in a way that's helpful to think about it is if you could imagine the mind as an ocean, and your platform or your anchor is your attention. And there you are in the ocean, and the more stable your attention is, you really want to make that foundation stable. And what you're doing with introspective attention is you're looking up for a minute and seeing if any waves are around. Because if a wave is about to come and knock me off and take me off to a mind-wandering ride, I can get ready for it and really come back down to my attention and really ground it. But that's a disruption of your attention, which is fine at first. It's fine to keep looking up. Eventually what you want to do is you want to have that firm attentional platform while you monitor the entire mind, the ocean of the mind, with peripheral awareness. So that way you know what the waves are, the seagulls, the sunset, the sharks, sea monsters. And you never, developing that capacity to constantly watch the mind, introspective awareness, grounded, will allow you to see when those subtle distractions are becoming gross distractions. So that's what I would say, do the two things. Do the labeling, do the introspective attention, but cut back a little, and really try to feel what a bright, continual introspective awareness is. And almost like a sense, look beyond the meditation. This is the breath. It's like your mind, you have a larger scope. That's the way it feels. So, okay. The difference between the bliss of mental pliancy, feeling, and meditative joy is a state. Yeah. One of the interesting things is that this is a very interesting question, and it's a question that has to do with stage 7 through 10. And again, I'm thinking to myself, well, how much background do we need to take to address it to everybody? So this person is asking, what's the difference between the bliss of mental pliancy as a feeling and meditative joy as a state? Stages 7 through 10, in a sense, the meditation process is about everything Chula Dasa said yesterday, and unification of the mind. Unification of the mind means that all of the pieces of our minds, which are usually in conflict, are working seamlessly together. So one of the practices, what everybody's working on here, whether you know it or not, is this process of unification of the mind. As the mind becomes more and more unified, as it stops working at cross purposes, there's a fascinating thing which just blows my mind. Is that there's bliss. Right? There's bliss at the end of the road, at the beginning of the road, in the middle of the road. Right? There's certainly a lot of pain, a lot of discomfort, but when the mind becomes unified, there's this incredible thing. Consciousness is bliss. Right? Like that thought, like that momentary experience is so profound. It's just so incredible. So this is the essence of this question. When you get to stage 7 through 10, and you can certainly experience the bliss and pleasure earlier, but you're really refining this unification process. You're really bringing all these disparate pieces of your mind together like a group of wild horses, right, that have all been tugging and pulling in different directions and fighting with each other. That's where we're all at right now, right? All these wild horses, and they're pulling. Slowly you tame one, and then you tame another one, and then one just stops running, and you drag it along. But eventually they get it, and they're all, just think of the thrill, and the intensity, and the power, when all of those horses are riding together. And that's what we're doing here. So people say, oh, those Buddhists are so depressed, and they're so annihilation. We're talking about, oh, we better not to be alive, right? That conversation, man, we might as well go off. Like, Buddhists are genetic dead ends. I mean, we're just like, but what a bunch you don't want to hang out with. But once you realize that what we're working on is this intense bliss, right? This intense power, this intense, it's just beautiful. So this is the practice of stage 7 and through stage 7 through 10. And what happens, the bliss of mental pliancy and meditative joy are specific events in this unification process. Probably many of you have experienced what's called piti, energy flows in your body. That's the early emergence of meditative joy, what's called meditative joy. And eventually that physiological, that it's not physiological actually, that energetic pulse, piti, leads to this mental state called meditative joy. Once that emerges fully, meditative joy leads to what's called the bliss of mental pliancy. So you've got funky energy currents leading to this state of meditative joy, and this is going towards stage 8, and stage 7, stage 8, stage 9, there's a lot of overlap. And then that leads to the bliss of mental pliancy, which is a, and this is what this person is a feeling of happiness. So this person's asking, what's the difference between this meditative joy and the feeling of happiness? And the way it's been explained to me, and the way I understand it, is joy is a complex state of mind. Joy is a global orientation. When you feel joy, someone could tell you your mother's ugly, and it's like, oh, okay, right? Because you're just joyful. Like, imagine someone just told you you won the lottery. Right? 350, oh, you guys are not attached, money's not dead, whatever. Just imagine someone told you you won the lottery. $350 million. Right? You would be in a global state of joy. Your boss could tell you you're fired. Like, okay, right? You know, it wouldn't be an issue. So it's like this, when you're in a state of joy, your entire disposition, your entire mental framework is oriented towards the positive, it's oriented towards the good, it's oriented towards the, towards just what's pleasant and joyful in the world. The other example that Chula Dasa has given me is like a kid who's just learned he's going to get the present he wanted, right? The iPad. I just bought my nephew an iPad before he got it. He's like so excited. He didn't even have it. It was just a mental, his mind was unified around getting the iPad, right? He was like, yes, iPad. You know, his whole being was so excited. And that's the difference between his, or like you find out the girl really likes you, and you're like, oh, yeah, she likes me. You're just like unified and you feel joy. And the difference between, let's say, getting an iPad and meditative joy is that there's no external object that joy is based upon. It's simply the fact of the unification of mind. There's no external objects there. So that unification leads to meditative joy, and that meditative joy is a global state. Okay? It's a disposition, an orientation. So even when bad things happen to you, you know, someone who's in a state of joy, it just doesn't really affect them as much. It certainly does affect them. So that's when I think of a state, that's what we're thinking of. Almost like a state, like a nation. There's the United States of Joy. Okay? Within the United States of Joy, there's different, what's a nation made out of? States. Okay, it doesn't really work. All right, United States. All right, it doesn't really work. I see what it is. Within this is, within joy, there is often hedonic feeling, a feeling of happiness, a mental feeling of happiness. Oh, by the way, joy can also be very physiological. Think about when you're in joy. You're excited, you can be sweating, you can be. It's not always, the state itself isn't necessarily connected to the physical responses, but often the question is, well, when you experience this energy current, how does that develop into joy? Well, think about when you're really excited. It's a physiological response. So the meditative joy is a state, and the bliss of mental pliancy is happiness, is the feeling of happiness. And what by feeling, it simply means pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is a pleasant mental feeling of happiness. So usually joy and happiness feed each other. But I was trying to think, can you be happy and not in joy? I certainly can think about being in a situation where you're in a meditative state, you're in a state of joy, but you're getting an unpleasant feeling, right? Like someone's, if you're in a mental state of joy and someone's physically pushing you, it may be physically unpleasant, it may not affect you, because that feeling of displeasure isn't problematic. But I spoke to Chula Das about it, and he says in some very high jhana states, there is a place where you just have meditative joy and no happiness. I don't know what that looks like. So I'm not sure. So, but joy and happiness. So that's the easiest way I can make this distinction is this global state of meditative joy and a specific mental bliss of mental happiness. It's a feeling state that arises because the mind is in joy. And to just give one last example, think about the mental state of sadness. Think of but depression as a mental state. Even if you're feeling happy or something good happens, even something pleasurable happens, that entire mental state draws that experience down into something that's just not enjoyable. So I think if you just compare those two, the overall happiness, mental state of joy and the mental state of depression, and then the relationship between the feeling of pleasure and displeasure. I think most of the time, not meditative joy, I'm a pretty joyful person, but people think I'm not happy. Right? They're like, why don't you smile more? Why don't I have to smile? That's the other way I think about it. It's like, I think I'm, like, I take things easy, but I'm not always, like, happy. So why, I'm trying to figure this distinction out. So how happiness, so let's just leave it at that. You guys think about it. Where does this relationship between this global state of joy and the specific feeling of happiness, and how do the two work together? Okay. Thank you all very much. I feel very joyful and nervous what Nancy's going to say. Thank you.